back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have the usual crew here. We have Josh Torres.
Welcome back, Brian.
We have Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And Chow Min Wu.
You didn't blow up your PC, did you?
Yeah, so thank you to Josh, Adam, and the rest for holding down the fort last week while I was not here. I was not here for a very self-inflicted, stupid, and small reason. So I built my PC late 2023, pretty top of the line for like that era, but I stuck with Intel for a CPU just because that's what I had known since the mid to late 2010s. And my computer was running fine-ish. Like, I wasn't having like the severe problems. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to bite the bullet and switch over to AMD, like get a new motherboard, keep all my components like otherwise as they are, get a new CPU on the new 9000 3D series CPUs. And I had it all ready and like, okay, this should be a pretty quick swap out, all things considered, and I'll be ready for the podcast. I forgot one really dumb, small, minor, cheap thing. Is that I didn't have the right bracket for my CPU, like all-in-one cooler, to attach to the motherboard because it was shaped for Intel and not AMD. And I normally am pretty good about keeping like all my, you know, computer peripherals, boxes, shipping stuff, like just stashed away in case I need it. But for whatever reason, when I bought my all-in-one cooler, I did not keep the AMD bracket. Probably because back, you know, in late 2023, I'm like, you know, I don't have an AMD CPU. I don't need this. So basically, my computer was all set up, good to go, had all the parts, but I just could not secure the cooler to the CPU. So I had to order like a $10 bracket. I got it like rush delivery to get delivered the morning before the podcast. But then of course it got delayed. I'm like, darn it. Why? You failed me. This is why no one should support you, website online retailer. I got it like the next day, and it like as soon as I plugged it in and turned it on, everything worked out just fine. But one related thing, and Adam can kind of chuckle at this. So, of course, I wasn't on the podcast last week. So I'm like, all right, I guess I'll play my Steam Deck because I don't have a computer at the time. I had finished Xenoblade Cross on the Switch. So let me try to finish Clair Obscur on my Steam Deck. And it was going okay. It doesn't run the greatest on Steam Deck. I believe Mikhail has a Steam Deck article on it. I don't quite remember. But I was glad that I had it so that because I was near the end of that game. I wanted to finish it up playing it on Steam Deck. But for whatever reason, in one of the late game dungeons, I don't know if it's the version of Proton I'm running or what, but the bloom was just not rendering properly for Clair Obscur. So I would enter an area of one of the late game dungeons and it was just completely blown out, like super high contrast, can't see shit. And I'm like, well, this is the last thing I got to do. So I kind of like stumbled my way through. Like, I can't see shit. I'm just like running through, like trying to like, oh, I can interact with something here. It's an object. Oh, I can interact with something here. It's a gestural shop in this town. Oh, crap. I ran into a boss. And I just kind of had to do that just for this one location.
Yeah. Just to be clear, this wasn't just like, oh, it's really bright and it's hard to see. It was like, no, you couldn't see anything. Like, he was blind going through this place. It was the Flying Manor is the location it was, which is a post-game location.
Yeah, and it couldn't, it didn't affect the UI. So I could still see, like, the interact prompts, or if I pulled up the menu, it only affected whatever was rendered under, like, the UI layer, how we word that. So I did manage to do that. I stumbled my way through. I actually kind of, like, found I think most of the good pictos in the area, but it was just one small area of one small dungeon. But still, I was like, this is really dumb. Why am I doing this?
Were you able to see like the enemy attacks like in battle to react to them?
I'm trying to remember. I think I kind of avoided all enemies except the boss. And then Clair Obscur, if you've been following it at all, it's very easy to break by design, and we'll actually talk about that in a small context later. So like once I finally ran into the mini boss in that location, I defeated him in like two hits because I was over leveled at that point. Okay. But I think I don't have a memory of like, did I fight that much? No, I think I kind of avoided all the other fights, fought the boss, and just kind of like blindfolded, just like attack. Nice. Because the UI again was normal. Like, so it was like, all right, I'll just do this strong attack, you'll kill him in probably a couple hits. There you go. All right, done. Get back to the normal area, and then cleared it. So yeah, that was my last couple weeks. Yeah, so not super exciting, but yeah, was able to finish Clair Obscur. I went back to Monster Hunter Wilds a little bit once my computer was turned back on, mainly. Like I wasn't really expecting a huge performance improvement, but going from the Intel to the AMD CPU, a little bit of one, because my Intel CPU was still pretty contemporary, but you know, has, I don't have the right vocabulary like James does, but has a high wattage pull, runs hot, was having a few intermission issues with, just for whatever reason, just the stability not being good. Every 2 weeks, my computer would just like have to be restarted for whatever reason. So I was just more just like, all right, let's just see how this, let's just run the CPU through its paces in Monster Hunter. So I went back to that, went back through High Rank, which I never finished, and did that. And then I kind of booted up Lunar. We talked about Lunar on the podcast about 3-4 weeks ago. And of course, Lunar is not a demanding game, but that's kind of been my last week. It's just kind of like, all right, now that my computer's back up, kind of getting back to this like backlog, that's kind of been my May plan, is just try to catch up on all these things. I did download Kazan. I want to try to get through that. So that's kind of where I'm at. But yeah,
I'm interested to hear what you think. Yeah, I'm interested.
I did, just because I was curious. This is kind of the mindset I'm in, and if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you're not surprised. Is that before I start any game, I'm like, all right, how long can you beat? Like, or how long to beat? Like, how long is this gonna? How much am I signing up for here? And Kazan is like, I think like it says, you know, 35 hours, but depends on how much you do.
Yeah.
And I saw some people say, like, I went to a Reddit and they're like, how long did it take you? And some people were like, it took me 80 hours, but 20 hours of that was on a boss, I think named Viper or something. I'm like, oh shit. I'm like, am I going to run into a wall here? But we'll see. I'm not the greatest actions game player, but I did stumble my way through, you know, some difficult action, you know, Souls likes for better or for worse. So maybe I won't get too stuck.
Yeah, I definitely have to put on my elite gamer helmet. They're going through that game for sure. There's definitely
Josh beat it before they nerf some of those bosses.
Oh yeah, it's so true. I'll be playing it in you know, weenie mode with
yeah. Once you're done, I get time to pat you on the shoulder like, hey, good job, Brian. I'm glad that I love that you went through it through the patched version. Just kidding.
Yeah, so long story short, I could not podcast last week because I didn't have like a $10 bracket. And $10 is probably, it's probably worth like $2, like worth of materials and costs. To get a replacement, that's how much it costs me.
Me and you are starting to catch up on video games though, you know, because we both got Xenoblade Cross done, then a Clair Obscur, and now we're going to Kazan, and then I have to go through. I've started my 100-line journey after Clair
Obscur. It's been fun to follow that on online, all people playing through it.
I'm very, very, very early in it, and I know I have a gigantic, long, winding road ahead of me. So we'll see how that goes. I'm a fast reader, though, so maybe that'll save some part of it for me.
Mm-hmm. But that was my week. But for this week of the podcast, it's been kind of a little bit of a slower week. We have a few games that are kind of teed up for the back half of the month. And of course, going into June timeframe, that's when a whole bunch of things, including a whole new console launch. Are we less than a month away from Switch 2? I'm trying to remind myself.
Yes, we are less than a month away. June 5th.
5th. Yeah.
Yeah, we're recording this on May 10th. So hard to believe we're less than a month away from Switch 2. But anyways, so I was not here last week. I did read the outline, but I'll be honest, I did not listen to the podcast. I believe you were talking about, like, I think Chow took center stage for a bit to talk about something he was playing, but I don't have the context. And is this Tokimeki Memorial related to that or not? Sorry, I didn't prepare as well as I probably could have coming into this, having missed a week.
Yes.
Yeah, because last week he was like sort of getting like prepping for this upcoming, well, now re-released version of Tokimeki Memorial on Switch, with like, you know, redone visuals, updated UI, and stuff. So he was playing a spin-off of it from the 90s called Mitsumete Night, which is basically that game but like in a medieval setting. So that's what we were talking about last week, and then Adam was giving his thoughts on Mandragora last week. So now Chao is gonna tell us about his playthrough of Tokimeki Memorial on that re-released on Switch. I think it's exclusive to Switch for now.
It's exclusive to Switch for now.
Yeah, and only it didn't. It's only exclusive in Japan. Like only Japanese script in it can get localized anywhere else on like the upcoming Two Heart remake. But yeah, and it's Chao, like it's hard to describe to people like how significant this game is for. Like that particular dating sim genre, like this is definitely one of the OGs, so to speak, out of Japan that really, like, kind of sparked, like, a generation of dating sims. It's hard to really kind of get that point across to people who may not know its historical context, like, just in gaming history in general, right?
Yeah. Like, I could even tell you, like, one of the characters in this game actually inspired Hideo Kojima to write, like, one of the sub-size story spin-off games to it.
Oh, like, yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm not a big fan of Kojima myself, but this game actually inspired Kojima in some ways, right? Yeah. And even the Castlevania creator, Iga, is also one of the main staff for Tokimeki Memorial when it first started, right?
Yeah, so. Konami. So, yeah, let's get into it. So, like, what's the full title? It's like, Tokimeki Memorial, Forever With You. Was there something at the end, or just...
So the remake is called Emotion. They added Emotion at the end, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's like, Forever With You is what the original game's called, right? So...
Yeah.
Back then, the best version to play for the longest time was the PC Engine version. Then later on, they, like, ported to, like, PlayStation and Sega Saturn. And there's also a Super Nintendo version. The Super Nintendo version actually has an English fan patch out there if you're curious to play in English in some form. But apparently the best version after that is actually the Sega Saturn version, to be honest with you. It has the most content, it's fully voiced. And so that's kind of like the definitive version for the longest time, right? One of the changes that you play from all the different versions, they have different minigames between the different version. It's usually like you play like a Twin B sort of kind of game, mini game. Like, you know, like it's a shoot 'em up if you're not familiar with Twin B is. But you have like a different mini game, and it happens at like the school festival most of the time, right? Mm-hmm. So that's basically Tokimeki Memorial. So the best version to play is the Saturn version. There's a group that's working on a fan translation for the Saturn version, and apparently the whole thing is translated, but they're running into, like, debugging issues. Apparently the game just keeps crashing or something, and they're, like, looking for, like, volunteers to, like very good programmers to fix these problems. That's kind of, like, what the current state of that fan patch is, right?
Yeah, that's always challenging, especially, like, on a fan translation project level. That's all. Debugging is always tricky.
Yeah, it's way difficult than doing having the game code yourself, right?
Yeah, so to give people, you know, you might have heard me and Chow on previous podcast episodes briefly mention how Tokimeki Memorial works. This is basically like a dating sim where it's sort of like a stat-raising stat generator. So you take, your protagonist is this dude going into high school, he's trying to look, you know, for love, basically. And you get introduced to like about 7 to 8 different girls that you meet throughout this high school, and then you have to spend, like, you know, your journey starts like when you first enter high school up until graduation, and you're constantly like living out his days, like doing various activities, whether it's like, you know, go to the gym and you'll raise certain stats, you go to another location, you raise stats, or you take one of the girls onto a date and you learn more about them, you interact with, you know, different characters in school, establishing relationships and stuff. But throughout this whole thing, you have kind of three main goals: raising your stats to keep people impressed by you. Because if you're slumping on stats, you'll perform worse, so you'll gain worse reputation. So your people won't like you as much because you're not, you know, performing. Two, you have to make sure that, like, if you're interacting with different girls, you have to make sure that you're not really leaving any of them unattended to. Like, if they want to hang out with you, you're incentivized to hang out with them and, like, say, yes, I'll go, like, you know, let's go to, you know, the theme park. Because if you keep on denying them or ignoring them for too long, they'll start spreading rumors about you, and that sort of creates a domino effect, which you're, even though you might be doing well on stats and, like, you know, impressing people, if people are starting to spread word of mouth that, like, you know, you're being, you know, you're just, you don't show up on anything or you don't want to hang out, you're going to get a reputation penalty. So that actually will work against you if you're, like, not being attentive to people. And the third one is just, like, basically successfully, you know, meeting with someone at graduation and, like, you know, hopefully it's, like, you know, the your favorite character out of the choices, and, you know, having a great ending with them. You know, it's like, yes, I was aiming to hook up with this girl, and I fulfilled that vision at the end of the game. I worked towards it after so many hours and stuff. But it's kind of interesting, like the legacy of this game, Chao, because Tokimeki Memorial, as people have played through it throughout the decades, it is less about like the experience of like a dating simulator and more so a stat management simulator, where you're kind of, it's almost like a more of a calculating type of game rather than like more rather than emotional. You're doing it for a result rather than like making a having the feeling of a real relationship with a character.
I think that's what's crazy about the second game as well. Not about the first game, but in the second game, it's like you could do tons of things, and then that's why I love the game so much. It's because, okay, in the second game, there's a childhood arc, right? You play like a childhood for 2 hours, right? And whatever you do at your childhood has an influence to the game story overall in the future, right? So it's like one of the coolest things. Like, there's this one part where you could chose to fall off in the river. And this girl will come and rescue you. Uh-huh. And she could be actually like a secret dating candidate. It's like, oh yeah, I rescued in the river when you were a kid or something like that. Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, but, you know, it's just, there's so many cool things you could do. But the first game is like a much more basic, right? You know, it's like the first of any game, right? They're always like a little bit more basic, right? So there's actually 13 candidates. I know that sounds...
Oh yeah, I forgot it's 13. Yeah, I thought it was like around 8 or 9, but I forgot it's over 10 in the first one.
Two secret candidates. Like, the game always has some hidden candidates, right? One of them is like a consolation prize, that's what they call it, because apparently if you don't end up with any girl, this girl will show up, and that girl could be like a possible love candidate. And there's a secret one. The secret one, I'm sure everyone knows who the secret one is nowadays, but I won't spoil it for this podcast, but, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. people are probably still discovering this game.
It's definitely like, it's kind of like almost the secret super boss of this game, so to speak, where like getting this person to be like your destined loved one is like, it's super difficult. You have to be very... almost like min-max.
So I would say like the main girl is definitely the most difficult girl to get in this game. It's like the vice versa in the second game, where the main girl is the easiest girl to get end up with, since she loves you since childhood, and that's kind of like it. So they kind of reverse that, right? But the main girl is, you have the most time to spend with her. She shows up in the first year because you're childhood friends with the main girl, which is Shiori Fujisaki, and so you know her, but she's very hard to like approach in this game, because even in the beginning of the game, you try to walk home with her, it's like, oh, I don't want to go home with you. I don't want people to spread rumors about us, you know? Like, it's very difficult.
You just said you weren't going to spoil it, that you're like, here's her name, here's the...
she's not a secret candidate. She's not a secret candidate. She's basically on the cover, right? The secret
candidate I thought she was considered a secret. Okay.
Yeah. No, she's a main girl in this game, and she's the hardest girl to get, because she wants... like min-max stats. Some people don't actually think that she's the hardest, though. Some people actually think like some characters are harder to get than her, which is kind of weird, but it's like one harder character to get is her best friend. She has a best friend that she introduced to you like in the second year, which is Megumi Mikihara. So basically, the problem with this girl that she introduced to you, it's like, okay, I only have like 2 years left to develop this relationship, and depending on how the story goes, if I didn't go to the certain events, I don't even get to see this girl, so it could actually end up to be like harder to end up with, if you get what I'm saying.
Because you have less time to work towards it, so you have to kind of sort of prioritize your events for that, without neglecting anyone else for too long.
And some of the other girls are just like, it's like technically like she's basically, the main girl is like, she just wants like stats. Okay, it's that's basically
it's stat check the game. Like,
she's basically the stat check, but some other girls are like, ends up to be like more difficult just because they're not stat checkers, right? Like, for example, there's another girl that introduced within the second year, like your like the best friend that sits next to you that always introduces you like different girls. He basically has a little sister that's introduced the next year, and she is like extremely needy. So it's like, it kind of sucks when she comes into the picture, because she's constantly like kind of spread rumors like within a week if you don't like spend time with her. Fixing like cool senpai, but she's like very needy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like stuff like that, right? And like, this game has like certain fixed events. I think you're like playing this game normally, I think you'll like miss out most of like the story events.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like if you're playing this game blind, it's definitely easy to miss out on a good chunk of the events because you just don't know. Like it's the type of game that like it encourages replays based on like finding those events because like hey, it's like hey, you didn't see all the events, go play through it again and see if you can find these events. It was kind of that philosophy back then.
And this is a very fast game. You could beat it in, like, 4 hours. I'm not sure, like, you could play a video game nowadays and say that you beat it in 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's definitely some games that are tuned for that, especially, like, smaller scoped indie titles. But, like, for a game like this high profile back then, it's like, oh, wow. You think about that playtime now, it's like, it's only 4 hours. But it's like, no, it's because it goes by, as you said, very fast. So, like, let's talk about, you know, this new release of the game Emotion on Switch. Like what is there anything that like sticks out to you, because it's still kind of the same base core game. They didn't like completely remake it from the ground up with like new different things. It's like it's like that same foundation, same core game, but like a new coat of paint on it with some refined UI elements and some new updated artwork. How's that going for you?
I think they look great. You know, I still prefer playing on CRT of the old graphics. It's just like me. It's like no matter how good like I don't know, just use a different example, like the Lunar Remaster, like no matter how good like all this touch up post effects crap is, it still doesn't look good as a CRT version, right?
You have the option to toggle it in this game, right?
Yes,
to the original.
Yes, yes.
Did you do that, or are you trying to stick with the new?
I'll stick with the new because without like the CRT like scanline effects, it still doesn't look quite that great, right? You know, if you get what I'm saying.
Are there any options that they included in this one to like kind of emulate the scan lines like some games do?
I didn't really check it out because I just played it on like the better graphics for most of the game, right?
Okay.
But I'm saying like, you know, it's like this is good. This is the most definitive version of this game now, right? You know, you're not gonna go buying a Sega Saturn version. Well, unless there's a fan patch that comes out, then that's probably your choice if you don't understand Japanese at the moment, right?
Yeah. Did you try out that
one semi-related thing? I was playing. You talked about, you briefly mentioned in passing the Lunar Remaster, which I think looks okay, but it has just one setting that just is post-processing on or off, and like the top and bottom of the screen, like it's not as bad as like Octopath One, but it's just like really blurry, like at the top or the bottom of the screen. I'm like, why would you do this? So I'm
like that vignette depth of field sort of
effect. I think vignetting can look okay if it's super subtle, but for this one there was like a horizontal line on the top and the bottom that's just like super blurry, like trying to give it so that only the center of the screen is in focus. I'm like, why would you do this?
I don't know why they default it on. And the dumbest part is like there's actually even some more settings that it's not listed in the menu. If you press F5 and F6, you turn off something like the brightness at the edge of your screen if you play on a PC version.
Wait, for the Lunar Remaster?
Yes.
PC?
Yeah, I didn't know that until you were like, I read Reddit, it's like you could do that. And I'm like, what? It's like, what? Oh shit.
I was gonna
say, like, I really dislike it when they like bundle the post processing in one like on off setting. Like I want to be able to tweak the bloom, the vignetting, depth of field.
Yeah, me too.
And most games do separate it out mostly, but like sometimes, like if you want to turn on, you know, color grading or something, you also have to get chromatic aberration at the same time. Like, no, I don't want that. Why? Anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you try out that? It's new to this version of the game, but it's kind of backported from its future entries. Like the, I forgot what they call it in this game.
It's called emotional voice. It's called emotional voice system. It was introduced in the second game, but what is it? In the second game, it's like it takes up a lot of memory card space, so you can barely use it, right?
Yeah.
And if you own the game, it only features two of the main girls, right? It doesn't feature all the girls. And later on, they sold like packs in a magazine to get like the other girls. Like every disc will have like feature three different girls from.
Yeah, we're talking about the original release of Toki Memorial 2, and this emotional voice system is basically when you put in your name in the game, like the game will actually like
I'll tell you this.
Out your name. Like
I cannot use it. I cannot use it. Apparently, it requires a Nintendo subscription.
That's right. Because they like kind of get the data from like a database, so it needs like an online ping or something.
Yeah, it goes online to like download it, and like oh shit.
Oh yeah, I forgot that you needed that. That sucks.
But it's whatever. I mean, it's like, I don't really care if the girl doesn't say Chao Kun. It's like, okay.
It's over. Enough. No, she already won't say Chao Kun. My immersion's broken.
It's like emotional damage.
Have you tried it out? TV setting, handheld setting, like how are you playing this game?
I play on my handheld.
And everything's good there? I mean, everything's
good there. It's like, it's still the same game. It's basically a port, right? And it's like, you know, it's like when you get to the end credits, like the credits is almost the same as the original. So I'm sure it's not much of a difference, right?
Get new voices like Two Heart for this or no?
No, it's the OG voice cast. And okay. I'm actually not really familiar with the OG voice cast because they're like, I don't know, like 80s. Like voice cast.
Yeah, they were popular in the 80s. They were not as familiar with them as like some of the ones in the Two Heart.
Yeah, like the second game had much more like popular voice cast, for example. The second game it has like Yukari Tamura, right? You know, that's a very big name in the industry, right? But like the first game, I actually don't know any of the casts, right? So I could even listen to one.
I remember you were you ordered like the collector's edition for this. Were you playing that one, or did you just get the digital copy in advance while you're waiting for the collector's edition?
I'm getting the digital copy in advance just because it's going to take like, I don't know, 3 weeks to get here, you know.
And you get that's the one that comes with like the exclusive Blu-ray of like the anime, I think.
Or... I believe it comes with an anime that gives you like a non-credit opening, right? So you never get to see it with like without the credits. So that's what I believe, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's, you know, some people will shell out for exclusives like that, especially ones that, like, they have already said they have no plans to sell it separately. Whether that's true or not in the future, it's a compelling reason to get it now, because you never know, it could go always either way with that kind of stuff. Sometimes there's, like, just bonuses for collector's editions in Japan that, like, they just upheld. It's like, hey, we're only going to have, like, a Blu-ray release of this, and that's the only way you're going to get it. And then that's how it is for the rest of the time.
I also believe like if you get like that premium box, apparently they have like some DLCs to get like soundtracks of different editions too. Like you could like switch to like PlayStation soundtrack, Sega Saturn soundtrack, or something else like that. So I believe that's one of the features in there.
That's pretty nifty.
You know why I'm missing the Lunar Remaster? For some reason they use the shitty PlayStation sounds. They should have just stuck with the Sega Saturn sounds. It's like, that is a missed opportunity.
It was a weird era in time when you play like a game on PS1 and then on Genesis or whatever, and it would just sound completely different. And in a lot of cases, look and play completely different too.
Well, most of the music in the Sega Saturn version in every port or game is usually the best version because those are like music recorded like in the studio directly into... like this into the CD, right? So it's actually like a CD audio, right? While like games like that on PlayStation, it's using like synths to like MD to synthesize the sound, so it doesn't sound on par. You know, it sounds similar, but not quite on par, right?
Right.
So usually that's why the Sega Saturn version is usually the best version, right? But yeah, I'm gonna miss out on that, and I don't know what. Like, one of the things that I didn't get to mention about the gameplay is, like, okay, you know how you say you like to go on dates in locations? If you keep dating in the same spots, there are consequences, okay?
Yeah.
So if you keep dating in the same spot, you'll start this RPG battle with gangs.
And it's like an actual, like almost like that, the Final Fantasy-esque, like, old-school, like, UI. Like, you know, it's like you have the characters on top and, like, big boxes at the bottom. Like I remember it has like that same almost identical UI to kind of riff on it.
And if you can't beat them, you just kind of like fail to impress the girl, which is kind of hilarious.
But yeah, it's very silly.
And it's not like a major factor in this game, but in the second game, it's a major factor because one of the girls, like, apparently runs like a gang.
Oh, yeah.
You literally have to win the fight. So apparently, like, your sports stats is like affected like your stats like during these RPG battles. So if you go to the same spot, you'll trigger RPG segment. So I could safely say Tokimeki Memorial is an RPG.
There you go. Yeah, you're raising stats. There's some Very, very, very few turn-based X battle screens that are somewhat inconsequential. But, you know, it definitely has, like, RPG elements into, like, into that dating sim genre. It kind of sucks, though. Like, it felt like it was a good time, you know, to finally get an official localization of this game, but it just seems like it's not in the cards still officially, unfortunately, you know, because, you know, throughout like the last decade or so, like there's been a proliferation. Yeah, there's a proliferation of like, you know, visual novels getting official releases and dating sims also getting official releases, but it feels like it's still, you know, somewhat of a
we finally got Fate Stay Night, and from what people are saying, like, people have been counting the script for it. It seems like, unironically, the 100 line is the biggest script of any visual novel ever, which I believe it. And that was a day one localization with a dub, so.
Yeah. You know what I want, out of all things? I want somebody to port Tears of Terra to modern consoles. I don't want to, like, hook up a PS3 to play out the game.
It emulates well. Just pick up a PS3 copy, dump it, and emulate it.
Yeah,
that's what I did.
But, you know, that's still less ideal than just getting an official release of it. You know, that's not a lot of people are going to be like, yeah, I'm going to go out there and find a copy of Tears of Terra.
Yeah, I was thinking of, like, writing, like, a Lunar article to tell what the difference of the Sega CD version with, like, the modern release is. Like, no one's going to pick up a Sega CD just to play it, right? Of course not, right?
Probably not. Not many people. Someone will, but not a lot of people.
So. Yeah, that's kind of like that same boat. It's like, yeah, go pick up a PS3 version. It's like, I'm sure a lot of people don't want to bother with it. So
I'm interested to see how Two Heart Remake will do since that's actually getting a worldwide simultaneous release, and that's, you know, pretty interesting in that regard. So, but hopefully, you know, somewhere somehow behind the scenes, we can get this re-release of Tokimeki Memorial out in the West, and hopefully like a PC version on top of that too, which would be great. I just feel like, you know, much like how people are discovering Type Moon visual novels getting their official English releases, you know, hopefully some people are, you know, open to the idea of like seeing some of the earliest dating sims. Not to say this was the first one, but definitely one of the first mega popular ones. Sparked that entire genre forward, and kind of, you know, you still see a lot of modern dating sims today take inspiration directly from Tokimeki Memorial, because it was just so ambitious and emblematic at the time.
So what are the odds of Konami actually, like, localizing this game, you think?
I don't know, it feels like I have no idea, because, like, if they didn't do it now, I don't know if it's ever in the cards. I just feel like I feel like the heads at Konami feel like it's the genre is commercially not viable at the moment. It's like they feel like it just wouldn't be worth it, which sucks, you know, because a lot of their other stuff get, you know, worldwide releases, like Metal Gear, that upcoming Metal Gear Solid 3 remake, for example. But then there's also, like, very, very long-running Konami franchises, like the baseball one that they have, the one of the Toy Bob heads. I forgot what it was called. Those always are just Japan exclusive. So I don't know. I kind of feel like it's a missed opportunity, because it would have been. I feel like the market outside of Japan is definitely ready for it. They're very interested, but, you know, I'm not Konami, and I'm not responsible for that.
And Konami's kind of a little bit of a wild card just in general, just because they absolved themselves of pretty much their entire gaming portfolio for a while, and then they realized that was a mistake, and now they're kind of clawing their way back in. At least that's my perspective of it.
Yeah,
they were too hard on going straight to pachinko machines and shit. It's
just like... Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, they also had, like, I think they also had, like, you know, like a lot of, like, Japanese companies, they also had, like, an insurance branch, for example, they also invested in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anything else you want to talk about with the upcoming Tokimeki Memorial, or not upcoming, currently released, newly released
I don't think I have too much to share about it. It's a very simple game, so there isn't like really much to expand on, right? And it's made in the 90s, so you're not gonna expect like modern game development where there's like a billion sub stories about each character, right?
It's a very simple, straightforward game, and that's kind of what I appreciate about it. It's like you know, a lot of games these days are they're very system heavy, very mechanics heavy. While this one is very, it's charming and straightforward. You know, it has a lot of heart, and somehow also has a certain level of like micromanagement depth to it. If you really want to try to game the systems for a certain to go on a certain route, you know, which is interesting. So it's cool.
I do look forward to seeing them remaking 2. I think 2 is probably one of the greatest like dating sims out there, and I'm looking forward to it. And I just find it kind of shocking that not many people talk about 2. It's just weird, right?
Yeah.
I think 2 wasn't even as sold as good because it came pretty late to the PlayStation cycle. And then Konami got the weird mixed message. It's like, okay, let's do crowdfunding for free then. Like, why are you doing crowdfunding for free, right?
Yeah, so it's very weird. And it's also, I'd have to look into it, but I imagine that it's just like there was a lot of other markets, not other markets, but other competitors out there, like way more so than like when the first Tokimeki Memorial release. It's like, oh, it's a lot of subsequent games, dating sims got inspired by the first Tokimeki Memorial. You have more other viable competitors out there in the landscape of when Tokimeki Memorial 2 was released. It's like, you know, it's hard for lightning to strike twice when that first lightning strike like sparked and ignited an entire generation of dating sims after.
Well, thanks, Chao. I know it was kind of a two-part conversation with revisiting Tokimeki. Cleared up for me. So is it does it have a new title now that it's been remastered, or is it just the how does that work in terms
this
of
this has a subtitle emotion at the end. So it's called Tokimeki Memorial Forever With You, and now it's now Forever With You Emotional.
All right. So basically over the last 2 weeks you've been able to cover both sides of the remaster, original and now re-represented on the Switch.
Last week I represented a different game, but it's like they're game. Similar.
Yeah, yeah. It was like a spin-off. It was Mitsume Ten Night. It was basically Tokimeki Memorial, but like in medieval fantasy.
Gotcha. Setting. Yeah. Well, and the way you were describing like the secret dating option at the very beginning there, like the I guess like the bonus girl, I don't know what you'd call it. It actually reminded me a little bit of like it's very RPG-ish. Like Pathfinder Kingmaker has a very similar thing where if there's a certain character you want to end up with, you kind of have to min-max your way through the whole game to end up with her. So like, yeah, that's a reason why we can kind of cover dating sims, because they do have a lot of like the same sort of like vibe or feel or roots as a lot of the more traditional like on its face RPGs would have. So we've got two other games that we're going to talk about here before we go into features and news. The game that we have listed next is Lies of P, which of course released, was it last year or 2 years ago? Time flies by. 2023.
It was 2 years ago. It was 2023.
Yeah, 2023. I do know that it ended up in our top rankings for the RPG of the year that year. And we knew they were not shy, the developers, that they wanted to do DLC for it. But we didn't know exactly when that would come. It was announced earlier this year. Lies of P Overture was announced in February to release this year. So I believe ahead of that, we've had a few people that have expressed interest in either starting or returning to Lies of P. And I think it's listed here because, James, you had started playing just the base Lies of P game in preparation for its DLC.
Started playing and finished it.
Oh, and finished it. So every once in a while on the podcast, we'll, you know, especially on, you know, months that aren't quite as jam-packed as the earlier part of this year, we'll revisit games, you know, from previous years that we hadn't quite had a chance to talk about since, you know, we don't want to get to the game of the year, you talk about it for the last time, and then it's off the table. So returning to Lies of P, James going there for the first time, just tell us about your thoughts on it and how much interest or excitement you have for the upcoming DLC for it.
Yeah, so I kind of, like, when Lies of P launched, pretty much everyone I knew that's into Souls-like games, for lack of a better term, agreed that it was really, really good. And obviously with how busy 2023 was, the main thing with me was that I was like, okay, I'll play it eventually. I'll save it for a rainy day because I know it'll be there and I'm looking forward to it. So then when the DLC got announced, it's like, okay, I'll play it once we get closer to the DLC. And we don't have a date yet, but the official time frame we've been given is that the DLC is releasing this summer. So that could be whenever. That could be next month. That could be July. Who knows?
September is technically summer for the most part. So yeah, who knows? Yeah.
Please not September. There's too many games there already. But yeah, so I sat down, played it. The one thing I've seen people say about this game is it feels like the most like an actual FromSoft game out of all of these Souls-likes. I completely agree because it really does feel structured very similarly to Bloodborne. In the sense that, like, you start off with, there's all these mad puppets you have to deal with. And then as you're going through the game, it's like, they're not even really the main problem. there's many things going on in this town. This town is messed up. And then, I guess the main cool thing that Liza P does. So I'd say that the level design is good. If there was, like, one complaint I would have is that Liza P is, like, very, very linear. Like, very linear. Like, even Bloodborne, which is a linear FromSoft game, has, like, side areas you can find off the beaten path and whatnot. But Liza P is basically entirely linear. There's, like, one optional area I can think of that's kind of near the end of the game. That's still, like, 25, 30 minutes max.
But now, remind me, just because I don't remember from previous discussions and I haven't played it. Is it, like, a single contiguous map zone, or is it like using icons on a map like Neo? So it's more Dark Souls, less Neo.
It's a single continuous map. It's kind of like almost a straight line for the most part. It kind of like wraps around itself, like for lack of a better term, like visualizing it like an infinity symbol. Like, I'd say that's probably the best.
It's kind of like a spider web, where you have your, like, hotel, right? And then, like, the hotel, which is, like, your base, and you can kind of, like, go off in different directions from it in straight lines, mostly. And then sometimes you can loop back onto itself.
There's four entrances and exits to the hotel, or four main ones, I should say. And, like, two of the exits will basically wrap around back to an entrance. So that's what I meant by it. Like, if you really think about it, the game world is kind of structured like an infinity symbol, like very loosely, until you get to the final area, which is just like, okay, now you're just heading in a straight line to the end of the game. But yeah, it's not bad. I definitely think that I definitely hope that the if nothing else, the DLC will improve matters, because that's something else to do that's not just a straight line. Because it's going to like branch off, even though they've said that you can do the DLC from a completed save file as long as you haven't gone into New Game Plus, which makes sense. Because if you decide not to immediately do New Game Plus, it just drops you in the game world. And it's like, well, finish up, do whatever you want, finish up. Gameplay is good. It felt good to play. I didn't explore too much with the handle system, mostly because I ended up going with a boss soul weapon for my playthrough, because I went technique. I ended up going with the Archbishop's trident for pretty much the entirety of my playthrough once I got that, which is a really good weapon. But because of that, I didn't really explore too much with the handles. If I do another playthrough, I'll probably try and explore that system, because from what I've seen, it's very neat. Because basically the attributes of your weapon are based both off of the blade and the handle, and that includes like your special like abilities you can use, which means that if you have like a special ability you like, but you don't like, well, that's part of the handle, but you don't like the blade, you can swap out the blade and still get that special ability, and vice versa.
And also, it's been a while since I played it, but I do remember the different handles also will determine like your animation for your swing. So I remember there was a certain animation that I got really used to. So like, I think that was the handle. So like, okay, I always want to use this type of handle, and then I might change out the blade or use a similar handle, but I didn't want to change the handle too much because I didn't want to have to learn a different animation for like a normal swing.
I guess if there was like one complaint I have with the level design, it's actually, while we were talking about this, it reminded me why I ended up with the trident. There's a lot of areas, especially later in the game, where you're in kind of like tight corridors. And for a brief amount of time, I was using the booster glaive, which is a lot of fun. But if it hits against the wall with a sweeping, like a sweep, it just bounces and I won't be able to attack. So the reason I went with the trident is I could poke, which I don't have to worry about it like hitting a wall and not like working.
That actually sounds very familiar. I think I specifically picked a handle that did like a vertical swing for the same reason, because I didn't want to accidentally hit walls. I wanted to go up and down.
Yep.
So I'm reading the Steam page for Lies of P Overture, and I'm a little bit confused on it, so I don't remember if other people have.
It's like there's like timeline stuff here, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it calls it a prequel, but also it says you're transported back in time. So are they only saying it's a prequel because you then eventually see events that happened in the past?
Yes.
Yeah, it's supposed to like explain like what happened.
There's one thing that I noticed in the trailer is there's a character in the game, Aladoro, who's the dude with the German Shepherd mask. And spoilers for a game that's like almost 2 years old. Eventually you find out that this Aladoro isn't the original Aladoro. It's somebody that actually just took up his identity. Won't say any more than that. But you see Aladoro in the DLC's trailer, so it's like, oh, we're gonna meet the real Aladoro then, probably.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, the DLC is, as I understand it, is supposed to like explain, you know, here's the beginning of this puppet frenzy or whatever they call it, and you're getting like some sort of view or glimpse of it. And I don't know if you're being actually transported back in time or if it's some sort of like simulation or memory. I don't know, but something like that.
Because if you're going back in time, I wouldn't call that a prequel. I would just call that going back in time. Prequel is like these events. I don't know. Maybe that's like drawing a very thin line between things that don't need a line between them. But still, got better context now than I did 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, game is good. It was really funny because I remember when this came out, a lot of people were like, man, these songs on these records are so good. And then people were like, what do you mean they're from DJ Max? Meanwhile, I'm playing this and I get a record and it's like, ooh, I can't wait to hear this remix of this song that has an absolutely dreadful note map in DJ Max.
I do remember we spoke very highly of the soundtrack during that Game of the Year discussions. So just in general, you think the soundtrack is really, you know, as good as it was reviewed back in 2023?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's incredible. I can't wait to see what you just know there's going to be some additional records for like other DJ Max songs in the DLC, and I can't wait to see what else they go with.
Yep, we'll kind of keep our eyes open during the summer festivals to see if we get a final date for Lies of P Overture, and yep, see if it's, you know, obviously the game has gotten, you know, really good word of mouth and critical reception ever since its release. So now, I think there's a lot of people looking forward to this. Go ahead.
Now, I can't say anything beyond just stating this as a fact, but officially they've said that there is a preview event for this DLC next week in LA. I can't say anything more than that, but they've officially said that's
very
a thing.
Mysterious. Very mysterious. So the last game that we have to talk about here before we go into a small amount of news is a game that released earlier this year that we did cover. We did have a review. Junior wrote a review for us. So in terms of RPG site, you know, coverage, we have talked about it, but we haven't really talked about it in depth with our core cast here on the podcast. And that is Ender Magnolia, which is like a Metroidvania-like game that came out back in, Adam, was it like February? It was earlier in the year.
It was early access last year and came out full release in January.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. No, thank you for the details on that. So we did cover it, and I do know that you had kind of circled this on your list as something you really wanted to get to, and now you have. So kind of back in the same general vibe of May being kind of like our catch-up month or backlog month, you've gotten back to to Ender Magnolia, which of course is like a spiritual successor slash sequel to Ender Lilies. So kind of tee us back up on Ender Magnolia. I know we've talked about it before, but specifically like your time with it, comparing it with Ender Lilies. And I guess since it's a similar genre of game, I know you talked about Mandragora last week, maybe you can make some, if there's any good point of comparison between those two or not. So just tee us up on your thoughts returning back to Ender Magnolia from earlier this year.
Yeah, so Ender Lilies, Quietus of the Nights, came out in 2021. And, you know, there's lots of different Metroidvania search action games that are released, especially in the indie, you know, sphere. So I knew this game was coming out, and it looked pretty cool, but I didn't, like, pay a whole lot of attention to it at the time. But then I saw that Ender Lilies was getting really good reception and really good word of mouth, and I had some friends who really liked it. So I checked it out, and I loved it a lot. I reviewed it that year, and I really liked the game. I gave it a 9 out of 10. I basically loved everything about like its presentation, its music, its visuals, its tone, its style, its story. But the one thing that I criticized about it was like the gameplay is just okay. It's actually a little bit claustrophobic, a little bit clumsy. Like the actual like action mechanics, the combat, the boss design and things like that. It was fine, but not really like the thing that I latched onto most strongly in that game, despite loving the game. So Ender Magnolia came out in early access last year, and it came out full release this year, and I've been finally getting around to it. I'm actually relatively close to the end, I think, so I haven't quite finished it yet. But straight up, this game is a much cleaner game overall in terms of like combat and controls and mechanics and how the different like attacks work. So it's more of a sidequel game. So Ender Lilies, it tells about the story of a ruined kingdom that is basically in the aftermath of an event called the Blight, which is like this, it's essentially this like poison rain that is causing all this sorts of manifestations and creepiness and ugliness and poison and disease in this city, in this ruined kingdom. Whereas Ender Lilies doesn't really solve that issue in the end. It's still this thing that's happening. And Ender Magnolia is kind of like, you know, you're now in a different part of the world with different characters and like a different tone and a different, you know, kind of focus, but you're still dealing with the Blight kind of in a different area of the world. So it's the sort of thing where it's not a direct sequel. You don't need to play Lilies first. You can play this first, but there are a few references between the two games. It's like a sidequel, like set in the same universe. It's immediately obvious that this game is a much cleaner game in terms of just controls and combat and playing it. It really feels like, and Junior said this in his review, it's one of those things that they really put a lot of focus on this in terms of the early access period, getting feedback, tuning it up, and it's a huge improvement in that regard. Also, this is maybe a weird thing to highlight, but the map, like the actual map that you use in this game, is really good. A lot of Metroidvania type maps, and I just played Mandragora, which I talked about last week, are usually just like boxes on the map. Just like you're in a room and a room is a box, and you can maybe see where the exits are in the room and maybe if it like leads up to a different room or whatever. But in this game, in Ender Magnolia, like the rooms that you explore in this game are actually like shaped like the room you're in. So they're not just boxes. They're actually like designed like the room you're in. And it's very easy to like kind of navigate around and see like, oh, I haven't been over here. I haven't been over here. You know, I got this new ability. Where can I go? It's actually, there's not a lot of guessing. It's very, very detailed in that regard, which is also an improvement from Ender Lilies. And one thing that these games do that's also just kind of comfortable and nice is that the map is gray. But then when you collect everything in a room, like there's nothing else to do in there, you've gotten all the items, you've gotten all the paths or whatnot, it actually turns blue. So you can actually go to your map.
Resident Evil 2 remake, that's cool.
Yeah, you can go to your map and it basically, it's very obvious, like, oh, there's something in this room that I haven't gotten yet because it's gray and not blue. And everything around it is blue, but that room is gray. So it's actually...
Part of me is like, that seems kind of gamey, but I actually kind of like it for this specific style of game where you're encouraged to go back once you have new tool sets or you're stronger, or you've got new movement abilities, rather than you just having to guess like, okay, now that I can jump higher or break down walls or whatever, where the hell can I use this? It's like, oh, it's going to be in this area because it hasn't changed color yet. I think on its face, I think I do like that.
Yeah, it's definitely a case-by-case type of thing, but I appreciate it for games like that and Resident Evil, Evil 2 Remake, where like you're always like collectibles are fun to get, and if they're meaningful and like are their currency to build to something or get something in the game, like you don't want to feel like you missed out on that because you didn't check like one pixel of a room, for example. But I would have bought that like in a game like a Bethesda game. Like, I don't need to know that there's still a can in the building that I explore, you know. It's okay. You don't have to give me that kind of iconic off. Ruffy or whatever and but that's the game's like.
The tone of this of Ender Magnolia is very similar to Ender Lilies. It's a little bit different. I think in some regards I actually do prefer Ender Lilies. But some people for the exact same reason might disagree. So Ender Lilies is a pretty lonely game. You're kind of by yourself and you have like an undead specter knight, I forget exactly what they're called, who's kind of like your companion throughout the whole game, and they're kind of like the only person who talks. And as you go through Ender Lilies, you kind of see these memory sequences, kind of as if you're seeing things that happened a long time ago. Like you're seeing things in the aftermath. You're seeing things that are no longer there. You're seeing things that have already transpired. Whereas Ender Magnolia has a little bit of that. But there's a lot more speaking characters in the game. In Ender Lilies, again, I'm forgetting some of the terminology, but you gain these different spirits that you kind of recruit, and they become your different abilities that you use in that game. And they all have different types of, you know, attack patterns, and some are short range, long range, things like that. In Ender Magnolia, it's actually a very similar system. In this game, they're homunculi that you basically attune is the word they use, and they become your abilities. And there's a good bit of flexibility there. You can equip four different abilities, but you get like 10 different homunculi, so you can kind of mix and match which abilities you like. Maybe ones work better in certain areas or on certain enemies or on certain bosses. So there's, you know, a good bit of flexibility there. But these characters speak also. And when you go to your different respites in the game, which are like a campfire, they will sometimes have, you know, some chatter, things to say. Not a lot. It's not a very talkative game, but it's less lonely than Lilies. And so that gives it a little bit of a different feel. There's part of me that actually kind of likes the loneliness of Lilies. But I'm actually kind of glad that this game is not just exactly the same in that regard. But it still has... a similar format where you like fight a boss, you see a memory sequence, you're learning about stuff that's happened. And the story is a little bit piecemeal, kind of figuring out exactly who is who and what's going on in this kingdom and what happened to the homunculi, and why are they turning into mutants and things like that. Like I said, I haven't beaten the game yet, but if you liked Ender Lilies, I mean, I think you're going to like this game. It's basically kind of a refined version of it. Very similar in many regards, but not exactly the same. So it doesn't just feel like, you know, a copy. But I've been meaning to get this game.
This game's good enough that I got to go back to it. I gotta get this on the list too.
You got to play Lilies and this.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, like for people who want to try this out, do you recommend that you play Lilies first, then this?
You don't have to. There are some references, but it's very. It's just kind of like I don't know anything more because I played Lilies. I mean, not anything dramatically more, but it does reference it.
Okay.
Like, basically...
And also, Lilies is also just an excellent game. Like, just,
yeah.
Like don't even play just, like, to get to this, but, like, play it because Lilies is just, like, an excellent game.
Period. Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Not a stepping stone.
Like I said, Lilies, I think the combat's just a little bit less refined than this game. One big difference, and I have to remember exactly how this works, is in Lilies, there is contact damage where, like, if Lily, because in Ender Lilies, Lily, the actual character Lily, she's kind of like a harmless little girl. If she gets hit, like if she touches an enemy, she takes damage. That's why she has these different spirit things that attack for her. So you don't want to touch enemies. You can't, not even if they're doing like an attack, but even if your sprite hits their sprite, you take damage. So you like kind of have to, you have to keep your distance and, you know, make sure that you're attacking at safe distances or whatnot. In this game, your main character is Lilac, who's very similar. You can tell they have very similar names. There is no contact damage. So like you will only take damage if an enemy is like does an ability that has, you know, like a hitbox or whatever that you have to avoid. It does lead to Ender Magnolia being a little bit easier. I think actually overall it's noticeably easier. Not necessarily a bad thing. I've actually been messing with some of the difficulty options that are in the game. This is the type of game where there's different sliders where it's like you can give enemies more health or have them do more damage or more of a stamina gauge or whatever. And I've actually been messing with that a bit because I was like, this game feels just a little too easy on its default. It's actually the sort of game also where this is kind of minor, but there's this menu that you can go into in the game where you can unlock things like artwork and character models and things like that, but it costs fragments to do that, and you gain more fragments if you're playing on higher difficulties. So it's kind of like, you know, it's an incentive to play on higher difficulties because you get more fragments to unlock more artwork. It doesn't affect anything material in the game. Like, you're not unlocking abilities or whatever. It's just kind of like, you know, a small incentive. Like, hey, if you play through the game with some of these sliders tuned up a little bit, you can unlock more artwork. And some of the art in these games is amazing. So,
yeah,
it's just a nice little incentive.
That's cool. Yeah, the early access period and feedback from the community has really, really benefited like the full launch of this game. Like, I remember, like, even when you mentioned the contact damage with the character model of this game, like, I remember them mentioning that to me, like, when I interviewed them back at PAX West last year about it. And that's due to that was a change they made due to community feedback. Like, the community has been really just instrumental in shaping this game, and I guess it really, really shows, especially with just the glowing feedback it's continually been receiving since its full launch back in January. So it's just cool to I love when games like this just thrive and everyone is just working towards like a better game at the end, and it pays off in spades.
But yeah, to answer Brian's question earlier, these games are not that long, like less than 20 hours, maybe considerably less. I don't know. So if you decide you want to play through Ender Magnolia, you can beat it in a week at least. So it's not a big,
it's the sort of thing where most games of this style, that's about how long they are. But then every once in a while you get your Hollow Knight, which is like, oh, it's a similar style game, but it's 45 hours long. And you're like, darn. But no, it's, yeah, I'm looking like it would be fun not to, like, kind of like what Josh was saying, not to play Lilies in terms of just like for, oh, I got to make sure I'm up to date, or I don't want to be spoiled, or I want to catch the references. But just like, I want to see, just compare the two games, what lessons they took, you know, what is the approach different? You know, the art, you mentioned the story is kind of framed differently. I once saw it described, I think, just Dark Souls 1 at the time. It doesn't have much of a story, but it has a lot of lore, and stated, like, I know that sounds a bit silly because some people, depending if you really dive into it, like how much of that is meaningful and how much of it is just vibes. But I do kind of like that idea of piecing together what came before. And I think, you know, Metroidvanias are a perfect genre for that, in terms of, I don't need a lot of dialogue. I don't need a lot of like actual plot, but I kind of want just to piece together stories or determine, like, you know, what event happened here in the past that impacts how it is now and things like that. So
there definitely is a little bit of that lore, you know, puzzle building, I guess, or like this puzzle piece, you know, piecing together your lore, Dark Souls style in this game, especially in Ender Lilies, though. And I said this in my review, and other people have said this as well. Valkyrie Profile, it has that feel
to it. Yeah.
Where it's like you learn about a character and it's more like a vignette style, you know, just like a little mini story, like might even just be a minute or two long of an individual in this world, not necessarily like attached to the main storyline or the main antagonist or whatever. Just kind of like, here is a memory of a single character in this world and how they, you know, basically their place in it. And I like that type of storytelling, and Magnolia is actually similar.
And you might not know exactly when it took place, but it almost doesn't matter as much. I'm not saying it doesn't matter at all, but there's a little bit of looseness to it.
Yeah, it's not like you're trying to put together a timeline, like this happened first, this happened second. Right. Right, so.
And sometimes you do need that, but sometimes having some events remain slightly ambiguous, I think, can be good as well. Well, thank you, both James and Adam, giving us the opportunity to kind of revisit some highly regarded games that we have covered on the site, but getting, you know, a different perspective on them since they've released. I know for obviously Enter Magnolia, it is this year out of early access, and Lies of P, it was a year and a half ago. But still getting the opportunity to revisit these games because we can't all get to them on, you know, release month. Getting us the opportunity to discuss them here again with a new set of eyes.
And thank you to Chow, who had to step out earlier because he had to go do some personal stuff on, you know, his time at the new release of Tokyo Meki Memorial on Twitch.
Hopefully he's not blowing up his computer.
Yeah, I think he'll be fine.
So that covers us for kind of like our initial game section. Of course, we've kind of teased up what's going to be coming over the next couple of weeks. So going into like articles and news, we have a handful of articles from games that have released or we've talked about because they're upcoming releases in the next couple of months. So obviously, a couple weeks ago, we've talked about Clair Obscur. We've talked about Clair Obscur a little bit. My time finishing up, and Josh, you also finished it up. I think we all kind of are at the point where we're either finishing it up or we're getting close. I know Mikhail mentioned a day or two ago that he was in Act 3 in our staff chat. So we're all kind of wrapping that up. We have news this week. I'll kind of combine these together. It did cross the 2 million copies sold mark. I think last week it crossed the 1 million copies sold mark, so the team seems very happy about that. We do also have a new feature up on the site. This one is coming from Scott White. Was able to get an interview with the composer, Lorien Tastard. And I don't remember if we've talked about it on this podcast. I believe we have, but it's been pretty like social media myth lore. How about this is his first video game project? It's his first like major project, I think, on any medium. He was found on SoundCloud by one of the directors or producers and brought on and just did a bang up, amazing job. So the fact that Scott was able to ask through some questions his way, obviously, is really, really cool. Talked about some of his inspiration.
A minor bit of clarity there. I've seen some people maybe over cynically talk about he wasn't just found on SoundCloud or whatever. Which is fair, but he's, you know, just like a lot of indie artists and musicians, he would share his stuff on forums and whatnot. Like, hey, I'm putting together my portfolio of music, and like he shared it, and he was found that way, which is like a very minor contextual thing. But I saw some people like criticizing the way that this story was being framed. Like, he wasn't just like picked out of a random box on SoundCloud from nowhere, right? He was sharing his stuff.
Yeah, and that's just an important thing to do, especially like when you're like in the indie scene of like, hey, got to put yourself out there because you just never know where life will.
Right. Yeah, and apparently the main writer for the game originally, she was going to be a voice actress, and then when they got more funding, they went for more like established talent for the voice actors, but they kept her on, and she ended up doing a lot of the writing, which is really cool.
Wow, so that's interesting. Yeah,
and I think really that's kind of emblematic of their smaller team, like having to wear a lot of hats, just in general, all the roles they have to play. So specific to this interview that Scott did with Lorien, and the French names, I apologize if I'm not giving them quite the right pronunciation. They talk about how Lorien believes that the human voice is one of his favorite instruments, which is why so many of the tracks are vocal tracks. They talked about, let me make sure I get the name right, Alice Duport-Percier, who is the female vocalist in so many of the tracks, and how working with her was like, talking about how he would prepare a bunch of music, and then there'd be a back and forth between him and the directors and saying, like, what track can we use for this scene? One of the things that Lorien really focused on is how much freedom he had. He would just put together tracks and just be like, where do you think we could use this? He wasn't, like, overly, like, prescribed what he had to do. He just kind of like created ideas, created motifs, and then they figured out places they fit. And one of the key ones that I thought as I read through this interview is one of the early themes. One of the most striking areas early in the game is Falling Waters. Mm-hmm. Falling Waters. What is it?
Flying Waters, yeah.
Second major, Yeah, the second major dungeon in the game has, I think it has a cool environment track, combat track, and boss track. Like, it does the triad. Like, it's a really fun area. It has really good music to boot. Apparently that boss theme, which I believe is called Rain from the Ground, kind of evocative of the area, he had created and just said, like, I don't think this fits the vibe of the game. It's kind of out there. I'm going to not use it. And then apparently Guillaume, the director, was like, no, I really like this. Let's use this. And that track has, like, different instrumentation than a lot of the rest. I believe it's like a synth accordion. Don't quote me on that. I'm not a musician. But it just has a different vibe than some of the other tracks of the game. And I think it ended up being, like, one of the favorites, at least one of my favorites. So just
speaking,
it's a fun read. Go ahead. Yeah,
speaking of the soundtrack, just to let people know, Lorienta Starred has the full official soundtrack, which is, I think, 154 tracks, or is it 164? 154 tracks over 8 hours. You can buy it on Bandcamp, the entire soundtrack, including, like, high-res lossless audio. £8, so, like, I think $11.
Wow.
If you want to get the soundtrack, you can get it on Bandcamp, and I'll actually post the link in the voice channel so we can...
And that's, like, direct support right there.
Yep.
That's cool.
And this one's a little bit more obvious, but I do like how one of the questions was, like, talking about the inspirations, about, like, which area of French history inspired not only the story and the visuals, but the music as well. And Lorien's like, well, I wasn't really going for anything, but I am French, so this is what I make. So it's just kind of like, you know, art. Like,
I love it.
Like, art, yeah, art, obviously, you know, all of your lived experiences plays into that. So it's just kind of like saying, like, no, I wasn't trying to go for anything, like, specific to a specific French period, but I that's what I grew up with and what I know. So apparently that's where I ended up.
That's kind of the magic of music, right? There's no right answers to your approach. It's very fluid, flexible, and emblematic of your lived experiences.
One of the other answers I liked was he's talking about the track Alicia. And he basically said he saw, like, a video of a dancer, and he would just basically watch this female dancer and kind of, he would, like, create a part of this soundtrack. And this becomes one of the major, like, character themes in the game. And then he would actually send, like, his part of this track that he was composing to Alice, that Brian mentioned earlier, the vocal singer, because she actually did some composing also for the game. So he would do part of the track. He would send it to Alice Dupuy-Percier. Was that her name? Anyways, and yeah, she would kind of, like, do the kind of, like, complete the track. I just thought that's kind of, like, this cool... you know, collaboration between those two musicians, and of course, like, the full orchestras, of course, that ended up putting all this together. So
yep,
I kind of just, in general, overall, I appreciate the openness from the studio developers, whether it's from the directors, producers, voice actors, now the composer. They, even up to the release of this game and pre-release, they've been very open of, like, conducting these interviews and kind of giving, like, some deep insight into, like, just the development of the game in general, kind of giving people a more vivid picture of what it was like creating this game, and not being so hush-hush secretive about it. It feels like they're very earnest about trying to be as transparent as possible of, like, hey, how this is how we made this game, this is our approach to it, these are things that we were inspired by, and, you know, and we decided, hey, you know, like, for example, the director being like, hey, I calling out Sekiro as one of the prime inspirations for, you know, the gameplay system, the turn-based battles and the parries, implementing that into. It's cool. It's cool that, like, it feels less secretive than, like, a lot of, like, you know, major releases in this space that, you know, we're so accustomed to.
This is a little bit more biz dev focused, but I'm also kind of curious to read about eventually, like, once all said and done, in terms of, like, the interaction with publisher Kepler, who has been relatively quiet, which I think has been really good. It's allowed the development creative studio to shine. But Kepler is, like, a British publisher. They've only been around, like, 4 years. They've done games like Flintlock, The Siege of Dawn, Cat Quest. But then, like, how did, like, I'm curious to say, like, how did this partnership manifest? Because it's, like, a debut studio, a relatively new publisher, and then just, like, a project that brought it all together and just has gotten all the acclaim that it has. Like, it's just cool to see that it's... Go ahead.
I'm not well versed in this either, but I know that Kepler Interactive is they're basically, like, the publishing label of, like, the Kowloon Knights, like, fund for indie games, and Kowloon Knights has funded a lot of stuff. And I'm not entirely sure, like, their model of, like, where they get money from and how they share money and how they recoup revenue from studios or whatnot. Even though they don't may not have, like, Kepler on the name, I know, like, Kowloon Knights has funded stuff like Sea of Stars and Eternites and probably a bunch of other stuff I know of. So, like, I know Kepler is tied to that also, but I don't know all the details.
Well, yep, we have the obviously we have the review from a few weeks ago. We've got the interview with Lorien, and then the news about both the 1 million and 2 million sales milestones. And that's for a game that's on Game Pass, right? So it's really impressive. And speaking of interviews, we also have another interview for this is an upcoming game that we got to talk about a little bit earlier. I believe it was earlier this year. Adam, you got to
Speak
to the Night Dive Studios. Yeah, GDC, that's what it was. About the upcoming 25th anniversary edition of a remaster of System Shock 2. You talked about how you replayed through the System Shock 1 remake. You got to talk to the devs about System Shock 2. You got to play it. You talked a little bit about your time with your small hands-on session with the System Shock 2 25th anniversary remaster, which is slated to release a little over a month from now, late June. And Mikhail was able to also get with the studio head, Stephen Kirk, talking about his time as a game developer, how Night Dive came to be, and how System Shock 2...
Stephen Kick, actually.
It's Kick? Oh, sorry. It says Kick, but my brain just auto-corrected it to Kirk.
Well, you said Kirk. I'm like, wait, was I misreading it? Like, I thought it was Kick.
No, I just... my brain just tried to correct it in my head as I read it. No, it's Kick. I apologize. Yeah, Stephen Kick. But he talks about... this is, again, an interview we have up on the site, rpgsite.net. And he calls it Coming Full Circle, mainly because... Through the course of the interview, he describes System Shock 2 as probably the main reason why Night Dive Studios exists. So he worked at Sony as a character artist, but decided to take a break. Apparently, he and his wife took a road trip, hiking trip through Mexico, Central South America,
Guatemala,
and throughout the course of that, I guess was playing System Shock 2 and a few other classic games on an old laptop. And this kind of revitalized his... He had to step away from, AAA game dev from Sony, but still obviously had grown up being a big fan of video games, including System Shock 2. And then during that time, kind of revitalized his love for it, and kind of is if not for that experience, would not Night Dive wouldn't exist. And the fact that now Night Dive has had a really good success with System Shock Remaster, and now is planning to launch System Shock 2 25th Anniversary Remaster... just again, I think titling this as a full circle moment really is the best way to frame it. So a second really great interview up on the site for this week. So one with the composer of Clair Obscure, Expedition 33, and then one with Stephen Kick for Night Dive Studios in the upcoming System Shock 2 25th Anniversary Edition.
Yeah, just both phenomenal pieces. Mm-hmm. That definitely worth the read.
I really do it feels in the last couple of years, RPG Site, we've always done interviews, but it feels we've been able to do them in a lot more and a lot of more different contexts over the last few years. It's been really cool to see. I don't know if that's related to pandemic or what, but just a lot of people coming out really trying to share, where their inspiration and love and creativity for all these projects is coming from and kind of detailing how they all came to be. Last week I wasn't here, but you guys were able to talk about Adam's time with Mandragora, Whispers of the Witch Tree. Adam, since that podcast, has written up and put his review up on the site, rpgsite.net. So it sounds like, Adam, you kind of did the audio review in the podcast, and then you went ahead and wrote it up for the
Yeah,
site.
I just have one addendum to what I said last week. Long story short, I know you didn't listen last week, and for anyone else who didn't listen, This game is a mix between search action Metroidvania and Dark Souls, which I know there's plenty of those, right? But it's just totally aggressively fine. I literally struggle to point out what's the thing this game does best? What is the highlight? And it's I don't know. It's all just okay. And I think I said last week, I think I'm giving it a 7. Pretty boring. Let's just go with 7. It's fine. But I actually gave it a 6. And the reason why is since the podcast last week, I got to the end portion of the game. And when you get to the end portion of the game, you start to, like, there's a little bit more reliance on these artisans that show up at your camp. And they're like different vendors that do these different crafting for you. Like one crafts weapons and armor, one crafts rings, one crafts potions and things like that. But in order for them to like to get like the highest level stuff, you have to kind of like train up your vendors by buying and crafting stuff from them with money and drops, like item drops. And it feels like this was just like way out of tune. Like the amount of gold and the number of items that you need to like level up your vendors to actually get to the good stuff is like frankly ridiculous. Like just imagine like, okay, I need to grind for materials now. Time to like go to this warp point and just kind of like run back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, if killing all these enemies to get these drops. And just so I can level them up. And it felt way out of tune. Like, they severely overestimated how much I would have at this point in the game, how much you need. So that actually dropped at a point. I'm like, this was not balanced well. And and in addition to that, literally the day after I beat the game, there was a patch. And the patch apparently adjusted stuff like item drop mounts and enemy levels and enemy stats and crafting requirements and things like that. I'm like, okay, they clearly heard similar feedback from people like me talking about this. You know, this costs too much. This is not really, you know, you have to grind all this stuff. So it's like, well, I can only review the experience I had. It might be less severe now, but yeah, that just kind of the way the crafting system was balanced in the game at the end. I'm like, yeah, I'm dropping it a point because this is kind of not fun and I think not balanced and not well designed, honestly. So, but in the end, I do think the game is okay. If you haven't played it, you don't necessarily need to go out of your way to play it. But if you do play it, you might enjoy it at least a little bit. It's okay.
And I think a description like that is kind of what a 6 kind of is for our site. If a game's just, it's fine. It's okay. It's not terrible. It's not, it doesn't blow your mind, but that's a 6 to me.
We've all been through that, though.
Always matters more than the number.
Yeah, it's also, we've all been through that of like, we've been in this line of work for so long, that like, we know how it feels. Like, you get out your review, a day or two later, they have a patch that's like, we have directly addressed your feedback or the things that you criticize your reviewer, like, well, it's a little too late for that, you know. It's sometimes time, comedic timing just works out like that.
Mm-hmm. And one other feature we have up on the site, I guess as of right now, as of the time of recording, if you're listening to this, it might still be on, is an open beta for Dune Awakening. This is a game that Scott's really been interested in, and was able to get a little bit early access to Dune Awakening and kind of put up a preview sort of feature up on the site called The First 3 Hours, What to Expect When You First Boot Up Dune Awakening. So if that's a game you're interested in, Scott did a very thorough kind of like starting out of the gate preview for that game. In terms of news, there's not a lot because we think it's all kind of being bundled up for the summer deluge. We do have PAX East this weekend, so some stuff might come out of that we'll obviously cover on the site and then put into next week's podcast if it comes out. But as for this week, not a ton. We did get more details for Rito Remastered, The Mystery of the Soulless Army. This is coming out for Switch 2, but on June 19th. This is basically the big June release I have circled that I'm playing all of my backlog stuff until this. This is the game that I'm going to get back to, not out of the backlog. So for this update, I don't know why I feel like I have to key in Adam for this. Like, the thing that I've seen filtered to me from this update is Mahjong. Can you explain, like, why Mahjong? I don't know if that's based on the original game or based on something else.
Apparently it's a very, very small part of the game. Like, it's not a major thing at all, but you can play Mahjong with some of your demons. In the original version of this game on PlayStation 2, this Mahjong minigame was just outright removed from the American version. Okay. It's not there. It was in the Japanese version, and they're just like, Americans don't know this. We're just going to take it out, I guess.
We can't learn it. We're incapable.
to be honest, like, even reviews at that time were like, they never really addressed it at all.
Well, I didn't even realize it was there, right?
Like, exactly. That's how minor a part it was. And even like, you know, the Western taste at that time, it's like, you know, a lot of people in the West didn't really care for Mahjong in a video game, so to speak. Like, especially when you have like other focuses like on the game itself, it's like, We're here for like the deep investigations or the battle system. You're not really thinking about Mahjong, and like, but it definitely helps that, like, you know, the Yakuza Like a Dragon series definitely helped popularize that integration of Mahjong into a video game, because it's definitely spread word of mouth to people of like, hey, want to play Mahjong? Go play these Yakuza games.
Yeah, I saw quite a few memes on this after we posted it. Like, people throwing Yakuza memes of Mahjong. And one that I guess is relatively common is like, the best Mahjong strategy, quit.
I have a friend, several friends who are super into Mahjong, and like, we kind of make fun a little bit, but in good spirits. Like, they know that's like, because they play this game called Mahjong Soul, and it keeps track of like your placements in games. So like, they always post a graph of like, where, like, when they played Mahjong for like the span of a week, what does that graph look like? Were they on a hot streak of being first place, or do they have like a downward trend of like first to fourth, or fourth to like third, to fourth to second to first? You know, so like, he'll have like infographs of like where his placements are during that week. So he kind of signs up for it, but you know, as long as he's having fun.
But anyways, the update itself, like the broader context of this news update that Atlas sent out with new screenshots and whatnot, was basically, you know, here's the city, the capital, and here are some of the different places you can go in the capital, including like the Narumi Detective Agency, which is kind of like your home base. And then Mahjong is one of the things you can do there. So they talk about a few of the other things in the city. Like, there's a shrine of like Yarakurasu, which I forget exactly what they do, but there's a function there and a few other things. And I have to admit a small mistake that I made. So right. the downtown area of this city, of the capital, is described as having a very traditional Edo atmosphere. So I called it the Edo era. I'm like, wait, this is not the Edo era. It's the capital has like Edo era roots, but it's set in like the Taisho period, right? Like early 1900s.
Yeah.
So like brain fart on my part.
Yeah.
It was described as an Edo atmosphere. So I was like, Edo era. No. So like a very traditional like downtown area. So
they also, as part of this press release, they finally like super clarified like what's going on Raito Remastered as far as the Switch 2 version is confirmed. They had like a mini Q&A to finally just address that directly. And the key points here is that the one, if you have the Switch 1 version of Raito Remastered that can be played on a Switch 2, your save data does not transfer between the Switch 1 and Switch 2 versions. So if you have like the Switch 1 save data and you want to use that for the Nintendo Switch 2 version of Raito Remastered, you cannot do that. Does not, for whatever reason, the Switch 2 version of Raito Remastered cannot use the Switch 1 version save data. So you have to start over if you're trying to do that. There's no plans to sell an upgrade patch, so there's no way to like upgrade your Switch 1 version of Raito Remastered to the Switch 2 version. If you want to get that, you have to rebuy the game. And not at a discount. There's no upgrade discount, or there's no upgrade path, there's no discount, anything like that. And it is a game key card, so the data of Raito Remastered is not on the Switch 2 card. It is one of those things where you get the Switch 2 version, it's a game key card, so when you put it to the Switch 2 version, it has to connect to the internet to download the game onto your system.
Let's simplify it. If it's not being published by Nintendo, Marvelous USA or Europe, or CD Projekt Red, it's a game key card. That's where we're at.
Yeah, unfortunately.
That's kind of what it feels like, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm glad that they, you know, were very super transparent about this, but when you just see what other third parties are doing, like CD Projekt Red and Marvelous Europe and USA, it's like, you would think, like, you know, Sega would have the resources to, you know, do this, what they're doing, and it's like, I guess not. Not for this title, at least. Which doesn't feel great to see. Unfortunately.
One of the games releasing later this month is Fantasy Life I, The Girl Who Steals Time from Level 5. The studio is really ramping up their nearing release, like, kind of marketing schedule. They've released a lot of their, Mikhail's covered these and called them song videos. So songs for each of the different vocations you can get. So there's one for the blacksmith, for the hunter, for the mercenary, for the angler. And the main thing here that I learned is I didn't realize that one of the composers for Fantasy Life, not just this game, but apparently some of the 3DS titles, is Nobuo Uematsu. So I was just reading like The Angler's Life, composed by Nobuo Uematsu, and I'm like, oh, what? I know that guy. So I figure I was obligated to mention that on this podcast. But yeah, we have all those songs up on the site. It is also getting a Switch 2 edition. So the game's releasing in...
Thank God, and you can actually upgrade to it. Thank God.
Right, I was going to get to that. So it's getting a Switch 2 edition. It's getting it'll have a paid upgrade. So did we ever get brass tacks on that? Are paid upgrades $10, or is it just kind of depend?
It depends. Apparently, this one is going to be like $3 or something.
Oh, that's nice. But yeah, it will have an upgrade. So it's releasing in May 21st. So this month for everything else: Switch 1, PC, PlayStation, Xbox. And then it'll support Switch 2 once the Switch 2 releases.
Sorry, I was just like reading over the Rido Remastered Q&A one more time, and they even specifically mentioned that Rido Remastered does not support the game share feature on Switch 2 as well. So like, if you want to digitally like let someone borrow that game based on how game share works, I guess Atlas Sega is not allowing you to use the game share feature on Rido Remastered for Switch 2.
Game share is different from the virtual game card thing. Game share is for local multiplayer. It's DS download play. It's DS download play.
Okay, so that's different. Okay,
that's different.
That up. Okay, all these terms. Got it.
What's it called when you're doing like the Discord like screen sharing?
That's game chat.
Okay. Got it.
So, okay.
Nobody's going to be using that Discord stuff. Like, everyone has, like, Discord set up. Well, so few people are actually going to use that, especially when the, like, actual gameplay is, like, 15 FPS. When you're watching, like, your friends, it's like, oh, man.
So, game share is when you do, like, your 2-week loan out to your family account consoles, right?
No, that is the virtual game card.
That's what I thought. That's what I thought too.
I don't know the specific name for that. Game share is the DS download play thing.
We promise we cover video games. We just we have to reorganize our brain to figure out, okay, how is Nintendo doing this? And sometimes it requires a few refreshes. So if you think I apologize if you've got this all nailed down and we have to remind ourselves. Thank you, James, for setting us straight how all this works. So that kind of, we don't have a lot more news than that. We talked about Clair Obscur hit the 2 million copies sold. It did also have a patch. This patch was covering a lot of like bugs in terms of like places on the world map you could physically get stuck. It did do a very small balance pass for a very specific skill, Stendhal, which was a skill that has almost famously at this point kind of become like the Zen motto of the game in terms of being able to do really high damage without a lot of setup or cost. I actually ran into this when I was fighting one of the post-game bosses. I was chatting with Adam, of course. I'm playing with this on my Steam Deck, and I was doing one of the post-game bosses and trying to really learn the parry window and like getting better, getting, you know, doing, making progress. And then eventually I'm like, oh, I just did 30 million damage with the skill and I one-shot the boss. I guess I Zanmotto'd it, but I'm okay with that because I Zanmotto'd Penis in Final Fantasy X, so there you go. It's even Stevens. But they it's still very strong skill, but they nerfed that. They fixed some of the UI issues. I had this issue where you're doing like the picto menu, and for whatever reason, at least on my version of the game, it would stop highlighting like what you currently, like normally whatever you have selected is kind of like darkened in terms of like this is your current selection, but for mine that went away. It looks like they discussed that a little bit. I did see some notes on Reddit about cutscenes crashing after the update. I assume that's been addressed, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure if it's been addressed, but there's definitely some performance issues after that update. I don't know. As of this recording right now, I'm not aware that they sent out another hotfix to fix those or not. But there was definitely some issues after that big update that some people were experiencing. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Stendhal is still a crazy skill nonetheless. I mean, instead of like, if you're doing like a build, like for example, one of my friends like did some testing on it, Instead of, like, for example, doing 1 billion damage on an enemy with that skill, it only does, like, 300 million now. It's like, oh no, it's unplayable now. What will you do? It only does 300 million damage instead of 1 billion damage now. It was funny because when they were through the patch notes, it's like, what did they exactly do to this skill? And apparently there was a bug on that, on the weapon itself, Medallum, which is kind of like a key component of doing, of maximizing the damage on Stendhal. Medallum is like a weapon for Mael, and as people know who have played that game, Mael's biggest damage stance is Virtuoso, does basically 200% damage in that stance. So there was a modifier on Medallum where on paper, like, the level 20 upgrade does like double damage on like the burn damage on an enemy. So, like, you know, when you're doing like burn damage, it'll double that. But for whatever reason, there was a bug on Medallum where it just
all damage was doubled when they were burning.
Yeah, all your damage was doubled, no matter what. So it's like, okay.
Honestly, but, like, the way I read it, it's like, oh, I'm pretty, like, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, so they want you to keep it burning so you're doing more damage, right? And I didn't think it was a bug. I don't even think it was a bug. They just made it, like, retroactively a bug because they realized, well, oh, shit, this is too broken.
Now, they did say in their socials, like, they want you, the way they worded it is that they want you to be able to break the game. Like, their goal is not perfect balance, but they said even in the mindset of we want you to break the game, this is still an outlier, so we want to kind of rein it in a little bit. So that was kind of their contextualizing of the update, which I can kind of get. They're like, yep, you know, you can definitely trivialize things in certain ways, but this almost made it an I win button, and it still honestly is kind of
an I win button. yeah. So I don't know if, like, it was really crazy to, like, balance a single player RPG because people can still spec into it and they'll still have,
right,
like you can reproduce the same results either way. Yeah. So it's like, it's kind of one of those weird things. So yeah, it's kind of whatever because there's like a zero sum game, bro. Like, nothing was really lost, nothing was really gained in this process.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like this skill only easily does, and I know numbers. I think I've seen numbers in the billions, but like, it's like this game, this skill only does, pick some random set of bonus attributes, 30 million instead of 80 million. It's like, well, that's still more health than the strongest boss has. So has it really changed anything? Not really.
Well, it's whatever. I mean, it's not for people to decide whether they want to break the game or not, because it comes with costs and consequences. Like, if you go to that route, you will hear less of like the battle music, like some of the unique battle music, because you end fights so fast, or you won't even see the enemy, like any of the enemy's attacks at all, and some of them have really cool animations, you know.
Or if your Steam Deck screen is all blown out and you just need a high win button, right. There you go.
Yes. You know,
I wonder if you would have been able to fix that if you had installed the Renault DX HDR mod. Well, no, you're on a regular Steam Deck, not an OLED.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't know if there was a different version of Proton I could use. I don't really know that very well, but I stumbled through it. In terms of dates, one of the upcoming dates, we have our first DLC launch for, first major DLC launch for Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 as part of its expansion pass. This is Brushes with Death DLC, launches on May 15th. So we don't know a lot about this. It just says, like, if you go to the expansion pass page for Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, it just says new quest line, help a troubled artist. And then there's a little trailer that shows that he's like speaking with the dead. So it's one of those things where, like, I don't know. I'll frame it like this. When I played Kingdom Come Deliverance 1 with all the DLC added, I really did appreciate that they're all just kind of integrated. It doesn't feel like you go to a separate place or do a separate thing for the DLC. But it does mean, like, as it comes out, it's just going to feel like any other side quest, maybe. So I don't really know. It'll be interesting to see how the reception is. I will say, for Kingdom Come Deliverance 1, I think the DLC with Teresa and the DLC with the Band of Bastards felt really substantial. But not all the DLC did. So this, the first one for Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, Brushes with Death, is coming out next week.
You're saying this DLC may have a painter involved, and like with the thematics of death involved. Hmm. Very timely.
That sounds like collusion to me.
Now I'm just imagining like Henry showing up in the continent.
Yes! Oh man, if they had a collab, dude. Henry and Clear Obscure would go so hard. He's like, what's going on? Oh, Henry. And they also have, it hit a new landmark in sales, right, Brian? Kingdom Come Deliverance?
Right, so yeah, we talked about Clair Obscur hit 2 million. Kingdom Come Deliverance, since its launch in, was it January or February?
February, yeah.
Has sold 3 million copies, and the original is now past 10. So Kingdom Come Deliverance, obviously doing very well. Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, off to a hot start at 3 million copies.
You know what? RPGs have been doing damn well this year, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And we're not even halfway through it.
Now, these numbers will only sound bad when compared to like the however many million billions that the GTA 6 trailer and eventual game next year will...
No, we take these wins no matter what. Who cares about comparing it to the biggest of the biggest? If the development studios are thriving and are successful and are happy with it and like it went past their expectations and it allows them to do cooler stuff in the future, you know, I don't care about like comparing it with any other game as long as those teams are doing.
I brought that up as a joke, but I'm actually kind of glad that you just took it like matter of fact, like, because that is absolutely correct. No, we want these games to succeed at whatever scale they succeed at. So 3 million for Warhorse and 2 million for Sandfall, where we'll champion those every day. Mm-hmm. Just a few other dates to close this out. Honkai Star Rail is getting its next update, 3.3, The Fall of Dawn's Rise, on May 21st.
I was gonna say like it must be a really weird one for the audience of that game, because it's like it's the kind of that patch before the big Fate Stay Night collaborations. Like I wonder a lot of the community is feeling it's like, okay, well, is this going to be a lot of like this banner is going to be a wash or this update and the banner's in it because they're waiting for the Fate Stay Night collab or what?
So. This is something that I saw on the periphery of my like feeds, so I might get some of the details wrong, but I think I saw that like Honkai Star Rail last month had like one of the best months in a long time for like revenue.
Oh, really? Like, wow.
And I guess it's purely because that game came out in April, like 2 years ago. So mm-hmm. It's all like these like anniversary banners and whatnot.
Oh yeah, there's always like big like, you know.
So like that's why they do them.
A lot of goodies, a lot of treats, and anniversaries. So, yes,
really big April revenue, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Dragon Ball Z Kakarot is still getting DLC. This one is part one of the Adventure Through the Demon Realm, the Daima tie-in DLC. Is releasing on July 17th. So yeah, Dragon Ball Z Kakarot released over 5 years ago. I mean, I'm not saying that's bad. It's just like, it isn't the sort of game that I would think would get that sort of, well, now that I think about it, Xenoverse kind of got
Xenoverse
that.
Xenoverse too, yeah. Like, yeah, Dragon Ball had a long tail. Like, even Dragon Ball FighterZ had a long tail as well with a lot of DLC characters, a lot of the balance patches and updates. Like, just Dragon Ball games in general have a long, long, long tail. They're well supported.
I think I mentioned this last time, but this DLC pack is $35 just for this DLC.
Did they mention roughly how long it is? Like these parts or no?
The thing is it's like split into two parts. Yeah. So it's got to be like put together. It's got to be a decent amount of content, like hopefully. Maybe 10 or so hours. Like
you never know. It could be maybe it's the Euden Chronicle. Maybe the Euden Chronicle it, you know? I'm going to use that as a verb now. Or
I need to unlock Goku Mini.
That's right.
I got like 13. Daima's only 20 episodes, I think. I think I got like 13 episodes in and then stopped, but apparently it has like a pretty good finale, actually. So I'll have to revisit the anime. Yeah,
I might have said this on the podcast too, but I remember hearing like people were wondering as Daima was airing, like, does this fit into the timeline? Where does it fit between GT and Z and Super? And where does it fit? And apparently, like, the last episode, the answer is it doesn't fit anywhere. It doesn't fit anywhere.
Let me get out the Hyrule Historia chronology book and see where this fits.
Yeah, this is the Goku Falls timeline or whatever.
Betrayed and put in the hyperbolic time chamber.
The Heart Disease one timeline.
But the Daima show, at least the first like few episodes, actually does kind of suit itself for like an adventure game or maybe like a light RPG. So I don't know. There's a look in the trailer here. I could see this if that's a little show that you really enjoyed, you could have a lot of fun with this.
Yeah, I wonder what like the future of Dragon Ball games are looking like, because they recently released Sparking Zero, and of course, you know, Dragon Ball video games will never end. If video games ended, there will still be Dragon Ball video games.
You know what they should do? They should remake the Legacy of Goku trilogy.
Yeah,
I love that.
Then we would be talking about Dragon Ball more than we typically do on this
podcast. Oh yeah,
Legacy of Goku 2, that was a good video game. I would play a remake.
Speaking of Dragon Ball, Bandai Namco recently released their like yearly numbers for their like business financials and whatnot. And the very overly simple version of it is everything is up thanks to Elden Ring, Dragon Ball, and Gundam.
And hell yeah. That's what we like to hear. The three core pillars of existence: Elden Ring, Dragon Ball, and Gundam.
With a little Idolmaster on the side.
An Idolmaster, yeah, to sprinkle it on top.
And then this last one is a pretty big one. We have a release date for the worldwide release of Trails in the Sky First Chapter. It'll be launching worldwide, Switch, Steam, PlayStation 5 on September 19th.
So that's a week earlier than I expected.
It's that last third of September, not in the middle. But this is the first time it's worldwide.
So, big news that's not really related to that. When they updated the official Japanese site for this, and I guess also technically the US site as well, they uploaded a couple of the tracks that are going to be in the game. And so those are up on the Fan Run Falcom Music channel on YouTube, and you can listen to them. And this is a big news for me and Josh, and Chow, if he was still in the call. They are not the Evo soundtrack. It's a new arrangement, and it's the best way to describe it from the three songs we have so far is it seems like they're going for a Xenoblade Definitive Edition approach to the arrangements, which is we won. That is the best possible way they could have handled it. We won.
Yeah, so to provide context, like there's later re-releases of the Trails of the Sky game called the Evo editions. They were like on Vita, I believe, and they updated like the artwork and to put a comparison on it, the OST treatment was like, remember the which Mana game was it? Not Trials of Mana, the one before that, Secret of Mana. You remember the Secret of Mana remake OST? That's basically the Evo versions of the original tracks.
I was gonna say that First Chapter was fine. It was really Second Chapter and the Third that was the main problem. But yeah.
Yeah, that kind of got more synthy and not really. It kind of was way more upbeat than like you would want it to be, because those games are going for a certain atmosphere. So when they uploaded those updated tracks for the first remake, it definitely, as James put it, was like the Xenoblade Definitive Edition, where they kind of kept the same cadence of the original tracks as they were, but just like some few minor like refinement tweaks in the instrumentals, but it doesn't like take away from anything of the original vibe and atmosphere. Like they're very reminiscent, identical to their original iterations, unlike the Evo versions, which kind of went overboard in some respects.
Yeah, that was like the last thing I was kind of worried about. Pretty much everything else, we still don't fully know what's up with the soundtrack, the localization. And apparently an ESRB like a blurb came out and some of the lines from the new release are in there and people have compared them. It's definitely different wording from the XC translation. So that whether or not that's just an editing pass or they seriously did a totally new translation, we don't know yet, but I'm not going to worry about it.
We'll see how it is, because there's definitely going to be a lot of comparisons when that release, because the fan base, you know, is very
at least on PC, knowing how the fan base is, within the first week, people are going to replace that translation with the original if they don't like whatever it ends up being.
So they also showed off some new things about the first remake with this new with the release date announcement. Like There are some DLC of like the classic costumes of Joshua and Estelle that's exclusive to the Bracer box.
It's so awesome. Well, no. Are you talking about the classic costumes, or are you talking about the like big blocky costumes?
No, not the big blocky one. The classic style Estelle and Joshua first. Talking about that's Bracer box exclusive, where it's like it's the original costumes, because like the updated ones in the first remake, it's very identical, but there's a tiny amount of tweaks here and there. So they still look very, very similar, but this one is like the one-to-one basically to the original costumes. And then the one that you were going to get talking about, like the pre-order bonus for the first remake, is these plushy Estelle and plushy Joshua costumes, where they basically are, I don't know how to describe, they're like costumes of like overly exaggerated chibi selves of Estelle and Joshua.
What they're supposed to be is, obviously everyone in this call has played Trails in the Sky, like the original. These costumes are basically like, you know how those are like chibi, like pre-rendered, like Donkey Kong Country style. They made 3D models that are supposed to represent the proportions of those for Trails in the Sky First Chapter. They are so right for that.
It looks like an amusement park mascot.
Yes,
it's great. Yes. It's so cute. I love it.
They're adorable. So like, they showed like a little mini trailer showing off these costumes. It's incredible, actually. They showed off the in-game character models, some of the side characters like Cassius, Professor Alba, Ina, Niall, and Dorothy, the journalists and reporters from the Trails in the Sky arc. Also, like in one of the, I guess, pre-order pages, they also showed off like the artwork of Lieutenant Flor. What was his name? Lawrence, something like that. They also showed off Josette in her Royal Academy costume, which is pretty nice. They also showed off some of the locales and some of the gameplay systems, like some of the new systems for the real-time battles in this game. So, you know, just not necessarily a new gameplay trailer, but a lot of new details coming out for this game and new screenshots. So a lot of really, really exciting stuff coming out for this game. It just seems like they're doing everything right in terms of like this remake, and there's like just how they're updating this game in terms of like the gameplay, the visuals. We'll see what the localization is looking like when it comes out, but it's just a few months away, you know. It's not a huge wait. Yeah, go for it.
In fact, please start with this one.
You know, it's up to you whether you want to start with this one. It has the first, but you know, maybe you want to start with Reverie, and you know what, I guess
I was told Cold Steel 3 was the starting point.
In all seriousness, definitely, if you want to give the Trails series a shot, this is a great, 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 great starting point. I don't know when they're going to announce the remake of the second game, though. That's the big caveat, is like, hey, if you're going to start with this one, just know that is the first in a trilogy of games in this like series arc, you know? And we don't know if/when they're going to remake the other games in the Trails in the Sky arc of the Trails.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they balance like the remake progression versus the final arc of the current, I don't know what you call it, the existing, after Calvert, whatever you want to. I say this not having played, of course.
Horizon, Beyond the Horizon, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, even Horizon isn't just Calvert. It's mostly Calvert, but there's some other stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see what the final arc is. And I know that I'm not the only one that's been like, I think part of the reason they're remaking Trails in the Sky is so they can do stuff in Liberal again if they want to, because they already remade Crossbell and Cold Steel 3, 4, and Reverie. So every region is HD console ready.
So, yeah, this was a cool, you know, finally locking down the dates, and every Trails fan, I imagine, has September 19th circled on their calendar, And for, you know, outlets like us, RPG focused outlets, all eyes are on this for sure.
I have a, what's the highest selling Trails game? Do we know?
I think it was like Zero or Azure in Japan. I think one of the two was like really well selling. But I do know that First Chapter, I think like back in the day, we got confirmation that like the original First Chapter sold over 100,000 copies on PC because it was early enough that it was like one of the first like Japanese developed RPGs on the platform.
I would have to imagine Trails in the Sky is the best selling one, just all the different sales it's been in over the years. People keep picking it up.
Cold Steel's probably sold quite a bit because it's been on PS3, Vita, PS4, PC. So it's like, how many reviews is Trails of Cold Steel?
I have the sales tracking for the series, I have no idea. I don't know on paper what's sold the most.
Trails of Cold Steel 1 has just shy of 5,000 reviews on Steam. Let's see, Trails in the Sky. Trails in the Sky has 8,000 reviews on Steam. So I think that maybe Cold Steel 1 might have more sales since it was on, like, the PC version was later. It was originally PS3 and Vita, and then obviously there's the PS4 version now, so maybe Cold Steel 1 is the best selling.
Also, all speculation, though, until we get,
I was going to say, with napkin math, with very wide error bars, with some speculation and assumptions, we're looking at, a few 100,000 copies for, the best selling
one. That
sounds
about right. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. So I was just, and obviously, again, that is us speculating with very limited information, but we kind of all expect First Chapter to do well, right?
Yeah, I think the big question is will this make the 500,000 to 1,000,000 mark? Will we be able to celebrate
one million
landmark for this game? That'd be, it's setting the bar high, but fingers are crossed, and it's very, you can recommend it to people. It's like, hey,
if there's any one game that would have the chance of blowing Falcom up in the West in a good way, it's this one.
Yeah, and not just we hope it hits 1 million because big numbers are fun, but just because this series has been up and down, but well-regarded, kind of in that niche enthusiast space for a long time. And now it is its chance to kind of break out of that space. For better or for worse, I guess I say for worse, but I don't really know what I mean by that. This is its one chance to really kind of put itself on another level in that sense, in terms of mind share, in terms of sales, in terms of being enthusiastically recommended without as much investment required to say you want to play Reverie? Well, then here, I hope you have 400 hours set aside to get the most out of it.
You want to play Horizon? You better have 1,000 hours set aside.
There you go. So it'll be really cool to see this, how this game is received in terms of, remaking a game that a lot of people are really fond of, in terms of potential changes to localization, in terms of a PC port that's handled internally, all those sorts of things. And then in terms of legs, this will be a fun one to keep tabs on from its release and on.
Yeah. So best of luck. We'll see how what happens when it comes out September 19th, worldwide simultaneous, PS5, Switch, and Steam.
This has nothing to do with anything that we just talked about, but Josh mentioned the Secret of Mana remake in passing 15 minutes ago. I still can't believe that exists, and it is what it is.
Every so often, one of my friends will remind me that of its OST, every 6 months. I'm like, why did you bring this up? I didn't. I already forgot about it again.
I was having a decent day, and then you reminded me that Secret of Mana has a remake, and it's that.
Yeah, it's
Just imagine if they had waited 4 years, it would have been an HD2D game instead.
What if Chrono Trigger remake is like this?
Oh God.
Like the Secret of Mana remake?
Yes.
Yuji Horii told me that they're remaking Chrono Trigger. It's happening.
Yeah. Yuji Horii in detail said that there's a Chrono Trigger remake happening in the style of Secret of Mana remake. That's exactly
what the interpreter said, and I trust him or her.
If you're listening to the podcast with no context, there is no news about the same news it always is. It's like it would be fun. It's a good idea. We like the idea of that. Like there's nothing concrete.
Yuji Horii stared into my soul and threateningly told me, Chrono Trigger remake, Secret of Mana remake style, and then
there you go.
180'd and walked away, and nothing else after that. I'm like, Horii, why? Why did you say this? Why did you say the words that would hurt me the most?
Like I said, it was a little bit of a quieter day, a quieter week for news, but we got through it all. So we're at the end of our podcast here. So we have the two interviews, the interview with Claire Obscure Expedition 33's composer, Lorien Testard, up on the site. We have the interview with Night Dive's Stephen Kick up on the site. So both of those are really fun reads. So thank you to both Scott and Mikhail for kind of setting those up and getting those all transcribed and written out for us. Adam has his Mandragora Whispers of the Witch Tree review up on the site. And then we have the preview for Dune Awakening. Of course, all the other news are up on rpgsite.net, so keep that bookmarked. If you've listened to this podcast through your podcast service of choice, leave a rating, leave a comment, leave a like. We'd love to see those. You can find RPG Site on all the social media networks. Just search for RPG space site, and you should be able to find us. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So thank you all so much for listening. Until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. And we'll talk to y'all later.